Hello, folks. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Federalist Files. On this one, we're getting right back to some of these Federalist Papers. We have Federalist number 79. It is titled The Judiciary Continued. It's written by Alexander Hamilton, June 18th, 1788. Topics include Congress shall not diminish the pay of judges. So this one's very short. This one should not take long. It may be this short. I keep saying this. It may be the shortest paper. This one legitimately may be the shortest paper. It specifically goes into just the provision of compensation for judges, how it shall not be diminished during their tenure and their continuance in office. They have a lifelong appointment or term as a judge, as a Supreme Court justice, as judges in general have, federal court judges. I don't know exactly how it works for individual states. I think they all have their kind of different rules, but I know federal court judges, it is a lifetime appointment, I'm pretty sure, especially Supreme Court, obviously. So pretty much it's just that the Congress won't have the power to diminish their pay, so it'll make them much more independent of the Congress's will, and they won't be easily manipulated by the Congress for their position, because their pay will be the same. It'll either be the same or it will continue to go up. It will never be diminished or lost. And this is obviously due to some sort of, I guess, the foreshadowing of maybe inflation. I'm not exactly sure. But I'm going to go ahead here. In this paper, Hamilton discusses the provision of compensation as it relates to the judges. The judges' pay shall not be diminished during the continuance in office. So he claims, and I quote, "Next, to permanency in office, nothing can contribute more to the independence of the judges than a fixed provision for their support. The remark made in relation to the president is equally applicable here. In the general course of human nature, a power over a man's subsistence amounts to a power over his will, and we can never hope to see realized in practice the complete separation of the judicial from the legislative power in any system which leaves the former dependent for pecuniary resources on the occasional grants of the latter." So just better said in a more simple sense, you can't have an independent body in the judiciary branch when they're worried about getting paid by the legislative power, taking away their pay and pretty much rugging their pay, taking all their pay away from them through some sort of a legislative act. Now you're seeing in the United States government a very similar push for vaccination through their employer, and if you don't get vaccinated, you get laid off from your job. Now your loyalty that you had before to your family, to yourself, is now being circumvented by the government, and what they're doing is they are doing it through private industry and not through the government to make it look like this isn't, you know, the government's doing, whereas it really is the government's doing. And it's kind of similar that way. Like, once you take away someone's paying compensation, their ability to feed their family, you kind of really do take away their freedom, in a sense. And a lot of people are willing to sell some of these necessary freedoms for a temporary feeling of some sort of safety, as Benjamin Franklin called it at one time. So Hamilton, he explains that this provision is to negate any influence that Congress may have over the judiciary in terms of the allocation of salary. This eliminates the fear that the judicial branch would become dependent on and influenced by the legislative authority. So now he goes on to state next, and I quote, "The enlightened friends to good government in every state have seen cause to lament the want of precise and explicit precautions in the state constitutions on this head. Some of these, indeed, have declared that permanent salaries should be established for the judges, but the experiment has in some instances shown that such expressions are not sufficiently definite to preclude legislative evasions. Something still more positive and unequivocal has been evinced to be requisite. The plan of the convention accordingly has provided that the judges of the United States," and this is a quote from the Constitution, "shall at stated times receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office," end quote. So he's saying there's people that are opposed to the plan of the Constitution. They want a permanent salary. And the problem with that permanent salary is it can be deemed as insufficient in the future. We don't actually know. So much more rather, we're going to have a stated time where we're to talk about what the pay and what the emolument of the or rather what the judiciary branch is, and it shall not ever be diminished. So if, you know, let's say a Supreme Court justice right now is getting paid, I want to say it's around $180,000 a year. It can't be diminished. They can't say the next year, oh, well, it's going to be $170,000. It can only go up. And that's to kind of make the judiciary department independent and not obligated to the legislative branch. So Hamilton, he adds that this provision accounts for inflation over time, considering that a judge amongst good standing serves a life term. Hamilton argues that this will provide stability, that provision that I just stated before. So it's stated times, which I don't know exactly how it works now. If I had to guess, I would probably say it's every single time they come out with a budget, maybe, which is every year or 2 years. Or maybe it's every 10 years. I'm not exactly sure of the reevaluation of payment of Supreme Court justices as well as other other government officials. I would assume they're kind of around the same dates, maybe. Not 100% sure of that. But I do know that, you know, you can't pay one Supreme Court justice a certain amount and then pay another Supreme Court justice less than them. Therefore, it does give a sense of stability, and all the Supreme Court justices are kind of treated on the same level, and there is like a camaraderie due to that as well. So next he states, and I quote, "This, all circumstances considered, is the most eligible provision that could have been devised. It will readily be understood that the fluctuations in the value of money and in the state of society rendered a fixed rate of compensation in the Constitution inadmissible. What might be extravagant today might in half a century become penurious and inadequate," end quote. So penurious is in like pretty much nothing, meaningless. So yeah, so if you look, you know, I'm trying to think of when my grandmother was born. She was born in the 30s, in the 1930s. If you look at prices in the 1930s comparatively to today, you know, you can get like a pound of butter for a couple of cents. Today, if you wanted like a couple pounds of butter, it's probably something like $3. So we're looking at 100-time increases, more than hundreds of times increases in the money supply. Therefore, the inflation does have an effect on goods. So if, yes, if you gave, when a Supreme Court justice was set, when he started, like, let's say in the 70s, and you told him, hey, that the average salary in the 70s was $100,000, or, you know, now if you, it's actually probably was way less than $100,000. Let's say it was $50,000 nowadays. If you're a Supreme Court justice, you're all the way at the top of your field. You're one of the greatest in your field. You're the most renowned, and you're still getting paid $50,000 when a really good salary would be around $200,000. So, yeah, so this provision, obviously, there's really nothing to go against this provision because the government, especially more recently, they inflate the currency, so they do need a provision like this. So there's really nothing. I mean, it's hard to find to really find an objection to this provision, which makes it's very uncontroversial. So he's going to go on next. He states, and I quote, "It was therefore necessary to leave it to the discretion of the legislature to vary its provisions in conformity to the variations in circumstances, yet under such restrictions as to put it out of the power of that body to change the condition of the individual for the worse. A man may then be sure of the ground upon which he stands and can never be deterred from his duty by the apprehension of being placed in a less eligible situation. The clause, which has been quoted, combines both advantages. The salaries of judicial officers may from time to time be altered, as occasion shall require, yet so as never to lessen the allowance with which any particular judge comes into office in respect to him," end quote. Yeah, so, and then he also mentions that the body to change the condition of the individual for the worse. He's kind of referring that everybody should be getting paid the same that's in the Supreme Court, that there's not going to be variations in circumstances, and there's not going to be one person that's getting paid $200,000, another person that's getting paid $100,000. It's all going to be very relative, very similar, but pretty much the same. And for that reason, it will provide some sort of stability, and it will not deter them from doing their duty because they're worried about getting their next payment. If you had to worry about getting paid because the the legislative branch approved it or not, you would bend to their whims and what they wanted you to do. If they were passing some sort of tyrannical policy, such as a gun grab, and you're the Supreme Court justice, and you say, well, I haven't got my paycheck in, you know, months now because they're not paying me or they're not paying me enough, you're going to be much more easily swayed to vote in the favor of the legislative branch trying to confiscate weapons. So this makes, once again, this makes sense. There's really, it's hard to find anything wrong with that provision. So he goes on next, he states, and I quote, it will be observed that a difference has been made by the convention between the compensation of the president and of the judges. That of the former can neither be increased nor diminished. That of the latter can only not be diminished. This probably arose from the difference in the duration of the respective offices. As the president is to be elected for no more than 4 years, it can rarely happen that an adequate salary fixed at the commencement of that period will not continue to be such to its end. But with regard to the judges, who, if they behave properly, will be secured in their places for life, it may well happen, especially in the early stages of the government, that a stipend, which would be very sufficient at their first appointment, would become too small in the progress of their service. End quote. So yeah, when it comes to the president, their emoluments or their payments, it's at the very beginning. It's set in standard the very beginning of their term. And then when the term ends, then it has to be agreed upon again in the next term. So that kind of makes sense during that term, though, that 4 years in office, it cannot be increased nor could be diminished or decreased by the legislative authority. So that keeps the executive more independent from the legislative branch. Now, that's not the same. It's a lifelong term in the judiciary, thus the reason for the fact that it can't be lessened, it can't be diminished, but there's no provision saying it can't be increased. So next, Hamilton explains the judges are liable to be impeached for malconduct. States, and I quote, "The precautions for their responsibility are comprised in the article respecting impeachments. They are liable to be impeached for malconduct by the House of Representatives and tried by the Senate, and if convicted, may be dismissed from office and disqualified for holding any other. This is the only provision on the point which is consistent with the necessary independence of the judicial character, and is the only one which we find in our own Constitution in respect to our own judges." End quote. So yes, I've mentioned this before. You can have impeachment for bad conduct in the judiciary department, similar to the president. I don't think this has ever happened, an impeachment of a, let me see if I, I'm going to look this up, impeachment of a Supreme Court justice. I don't think it's ever happened. A Supreme Court justice. I don't think it's ever happened before. The only justice that was ever impeached was Associate Justice Samuel Chase in 1805. He was acquitted in the Senate. The articles of impeachment were passed through the House of Reps, but he was acquitted once it got to the Senate. It's very interesting. I don't really know what that's related to. I should. I feel like I've heard of this case before, but I just cannot remember it at this moment. So to go on here, Hamilton is opposed to impeachment on the grounds of inability, with the exception of insanity. So this is kind of another interesting element of this piece that he talks about. This is an underrated paper, obviously, but this is a very interesting point that he goes on to make. He states, and I quote, "The want of a provision for removing the judges on account of inability has been a subject of complaint, but all considerate men will be sensible that such a provision would either not be practiced upon or would be more liable to abuse than calculated to answer any good purpose. The mensuration of the faculties of the mind has, I believe, no place in the catalog of known arts. An attempt to fix the boundary between the regions of ability and inability would much oftener give scope to personal and party attachments and enmities than advance the interests of justice or the public good. The result, except in the case of insanity, must for the most part be arbitrary, and insanity without any formal or express provision may be safely pronounced to be a virtual disqualification." End quote. So yes, he's saying inability, lack of inability, something that's very subjective. It's a subjective statement, and it would easily be tainted by party attachments and party animuses. The only time that you can remove somebody from the Judiciary Department will be in the case of insanity. Now, we've seen them try to politicize this with Donald Trump. They're trying to enact the 25th Amendment. Who's to say if they can do that to the president that they're not going to turn around and try to attempt to do the same thing to Supreme Court justices? Thus, the reasoning for this specific specific provision, which it makes sense. So in conclusion, Hamilton, he argues that an age limit does not prove inability. Now he states, and I quote, "We consider how few there are who outlive the season of intellectual vigor," end quote. He adds that the occupation of judge is one that needs much studying and long-lived history to ascertain and discern law, and an individual of older age is not only needed but should be considered common. This is kind of interesting. He's going to go on to speak about this a little bit. But what he really is trying to say, you got to also remember the time frame. People didn't really live that long then, so it wasn't that often that they lived long enough for their brain to fail them. Usually their body would fail them before their brain would. Somebody would die from a heart attack in the mid-50s. Their brain was fully functional. They didn't have any issues with that, but they would die from other reasons. So he goes on to state next, and I quote, "The Constitution of New York, to avoid investigations that must forever be vague and dangerous, has taken a particular age as the criterion of inability. No man can be a judge beyond 60. I believe there are few at present who do not disapprove of this provision. There is no station in relation to which it is less proper than to that of a judge. The deliberating and comparing faculties generally preserve their strength much beyond that period in men who survive it. And when, in addition to this circumstance, we consider how few there are who outlive the season of intellectual vigor, and how improbable it is that any considerable portion of the bench, whether more or less numerous, should be in such a situation at the same time, we shall be ready to conclude that limitations of this sort have little to recommend them." End quote. So yeah, this is very interesting, the point that he makes, and this actually goes back to science. Now biology, we know it to be true ourselves. People that kept their brains much more at pace, people that read, people that played mind games, whether it was checkers or chess or Sudoku puzzles, as they got older, they actually stayed very sharp over time, and they were less likely to kind of lose that intellectual edge. And what he's saying, and this is just his own common conception of what he saw in reality anecdotally, and then he took it and extrapolated it to real life, and then it ends up, this is true. He's saying these people, they're going to be deliberating. That will in and of itself preserve their strength mentally and intellectually. They will be reading. They will be reading through, whether it's case law, common law, you know, they will be doing their job. They'll be writing. They'll be reading. They'll be dealing a lot of things, keeping themselves moving, keeping themselves functioning, and an intellectual capacity that it should be able to preserve their strength in that regard, which he was right. And if you think about it, 60 years old, 6 years old, I can't even, 6 years old, most of our politicians are above the age of 60 years old. And that's what the provision was at the time, is you couldn't be beyond 60 and be a judge in New York, which is pretty crazy to think about. So 60, you're definitely still functioning. I would say maybe if I had to guess the time when you really start to kind of lose it, dementia starts to really sink in around, and Alzheimer's as well. Once you hit that 80 year old range, if you're not sharp and you're not really constantly working your brain out as if it's a muscle in your body, because that's kind of how you have to work it out, then that's when you start to see a decline intellectually, or rather cognitively you see a decline. So next he goes on, this is going to be his very last statement. He states, and I quote, "In a republic where fortunes are not affluent and pensions not expedient, the dismission of men from stations in which they have served their country long and usefully, on which they depend for subsistence, and from which it will be too late to resort to any other occupation for a livelihood, ought to have some better apology to humanity than is to be found in the imaginary danger of a superannuated bench." End quote. So yeah, he goes really deep. He goes hard in the paint on this one. What he's saying is, you have a bunch of people that fought for the revolution. You have a bunch of people that love this country. You know, it's in their blood. They love the country so much, and they're so later in their occupation of livelihood, and they already have so much knowledge, like a guy like a John Adams, like a Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was very older. He's one of the older founders. A guy like a Benjamin Franklin, they're saying, oh, well, how's it fair to have this guy that fought hard for the country, right? Did so much work. This was his livelihood for this country, and he wants to go in now. Let's say he wants to be a judge. Who are we to say that there's some sort of danger from that? Now, if we notice he starts to lose his mind, that's a totally different story. But how are we going to tell him at the age of 60 that he's not able to be a judge in our Supreme Court? If he's the best qualified person for the job, merit-based, that he should be selected or chosen. Now, at that time, maybe that's how it was. Now, it's pretty party-oriented. It's much more political than it ever was before. So that'll conclude this one. I greatly appreciate everyone tuning in. Next, we're going to have Federalist number 80. That one's going to be pretty long. I was just taking a look at it. It's much longer than this one, so stay tuned for that. It's going to be very interesting. And I greatly appreciate you all tuning in, and I will see you all next time. Thank you.